Session number 3166.
Air Vice Marshal Capel, Reel 3. Was there any other methods by which the troops on the ground could communicate with you in the air?
Well, there was a thing called the Popham Panel, which is a sort of canvas square on which various white strips could be laid out, meaning various things. It was used, as far as I remember, for indicating the position of forward troops. And also, I think you could send a few elementary messages, like ammunition required or something like that, but I'm not very clear on that at this stage in time. But it certainly was a method. But you must remember that in Waziristan, troops could only go out with a full-scale exercise. That's to say, they had to picket the heights if they were going to march along the valleys or anything like that. And in these such small schemes as they did, the scope for the air was very limited in a peacetime practice as opposed to an operation.
Can you remember what sort of exercises did they actually do? Were these cooperation exercises that you did all done in training, or did you actually see any active service with a column of troops?
No. As far as I remember, we had no actual operation with troops on the ground. But we did have operations where the Air Force were involved, but not army units.
What sort of training exercises then were you able to do? Were they confined fairly closely to the bases that you were stationed at, or did you go off on practice camps some distance away?
Well, no, from Dardoni, we didn't do practice camps. We were accredited purely to Waziristan district, and the troops were all up in Waziristan. The principal camp, of course, was Razmak. That was the big camp, which was about 9,000 feet high, I think, well into Waziristan. And then there were outlying units, usually guarding the roads, of which there were a few main roads which had been made. There was Razmak down to past Dardoni and down to Banu. Then there was Razmak down through Sororoga to Tonk, and Razmak to Warna. And there was also a road from Warna to Tonk. Those were the principal roads of any size at all.
And when you were doing exercises, training exercises with troops, what form did they take? How long did they last, and so on?
Oh, only very short ones. I mean, within the day, nothing going over 2 or 3 days. As I say, we had no operations that I can remember actually with troops on the ground.
You also took part in what might loosely be called air control operations, independent action against the villages of rebellious tribes. What was the sequence of events when you took part in one of those operations?
Well, the sequence of events was that if some tribe had committed an offence, such as managing to pinch rifles, or raiding down into shops in Banu or something like that, they were first of all given, by the political agent, they were given a fine or other punishment with which they had to comply. They either had to hand back the arms or hand over so many rifles or pay a fine in rupees or something like that. If they didn't do that, they were then warned that the bombing might take place. But before that, first of all, we had to do a fairly big demonstration over the village. That's putting up every serviceable aircraft, 10 to 12 aircraft, to fly around for a bit and make sort of passing runs over the target. And that was the next stage. Well, then if that produced no effect at all, they were then warned that bombing would take place. And as far as I remember, they were warned to evacuate their women and children and their stock. Let's say their goats or a few cows or it might be, before bombing began. Then they may or may not have taken any notice of that. In some cases, I think they did. Some cases, they didn't. And then they were finally given a date or time on which the bombing would begin. And if they hadn't complied by that time, then bombing did begin. The first one we had was in July 1924. That was against a tribe not very far east of Razmak. I think they were called the Acid Kale. And the head man was Arup, who was a well-known budmarsh. We took photos of the village, and we were allotted certain definite targets, such as the head man's house. And we started off in groups of three, flew out in formations of three, then got into line ahead, and then bombed as near as possible the correct target. And this, in this particular case, on the second day, I think it was, I was leading the last formation of three for that particular morning, and my other two were aircraft and crews from 28 Squadron Peshawar, who were attached to us for this operation. It took place during the summer period when one flight at a time were normally away at the hill, at the hill station. And therefore we had a flight from 28 Squadron from Peshawar to bring us up to strength. I was leading this formation of three, and after bombing, after doing our runs, we were just forming up to come home again, when we were engulfed in a very, very thick mist or fog, which came up very suddenly, and got completely split up. I, of course, knew the area very well, and I knew that flying east, the ground would get lower and lower, and therefore there'd be more, less likelihood of running into a hill, mountain. And I started off, as I thought, to the east, having lost the other two. But the Bristol fighter was not exactly equipped for blind flying. In any case, one had very little practice in blind flying. And I realized after a very short time that I was out of control. So I thought, this is it. I don't know whether I'll get back into control or what will happen if I do. But I came out below the fog, down in a valley. The hills on each side were covered in fog still, and I had literally seconds to get some sort of control, get the aircraft at least straight, when we crashed, hit a big boulder, wiped off the undercarriage, turned completely over, and landed upside down on the other side. Our belts held, and we were neither of us injured more than a bruise or two, which was extremely lucky. Well, having got onto the ground, we tried first of all to set a light to the machine. After striking a couple of matches, I realized I was trying to light a stream of water, not a stream of petrol. But by that time, we were surrounded very quickly by the natives, and they turned out to be wazirs, whereas the tribe we were bombing were Masuds. Well, we were duly captured, my air gunner and myself, and first of all, we always carried a thing called a blood chit, which was piece of paper stating that if we were handed in unharmed, they would get a certain reward. Well, so many people wanted this blood chip that it had disappeared into small pieces within a matter of seconds. So that was the only, so that destroyed the use of that. Then after a certain interval, which I think may have been an hour, during which there was a lot of screaming and talking going on, especially the women. The women were sort of trying to get at us, and the men were rather protecting us. And then another lot turned up, who turned out to be an expedition from the Marsouds that we were bombing. And then there really did begin an argument, and I thought it was going to be more like a war. However, after a lot of argument, I was taken off by the Marsouds, and my air gunner was left with the Waziris. He was handed in to Razmak the next day by the Waziris, who got their reward. I was taken back to the village, or to Arup's village, and met Arup and his gang. And after that, things got a bit difficult. First of all, we sat in his house, which was a house with the usual big tower. And, of course, I knew that was the target. However, it was still very foggy, so it seemed pretty safe. And after quite a long time, we decided to move out. Not, I think, from anything I particularly said, but because they thought it was time to go, I suppose, because of the language difficulty. Of course, there was one chap who talked very, very little English, and I talked very, very little Pashto, and the result was we could hardly communicate at all. However, the next thing we did was we went and sat round an unexploded bomb, 112-pounder. I didn't know whether it was a dud or whether it was a time fuse, so I wasn't very anxious to stay very long. And we moved away. It turned out to be a dud. I don't think it did explode. And then we went into went up the side of a hill into some caves, which was moderately safe. It took about 2 to 3 hours, by the way, to march from where I came down to the village. It was something I reckon 10 miles away. And I was there for 4 days, reasonably well treated, eaten by fleas. The chief food were eggs, boiled eggs, which they insisted on peeling themselves, so the result was that the egg you had to eat was covered in dirt. However, there it was. Then I was visited by an agent of the PA, himself a Marsoud, I think. And there was a great deal of argument went on as to what should happen. And the complication was that apparently this tribe had about 10 men in prison in Tonk who were under... who were going to be sentenced for various crimes, and they wanted to swap me for them. Well, it was impossible to let out 10 well-known Bud Marshes who'd been captured, and so the argument went on for quite a long time. But eventually, I was brought into Sororoga with a huge crowd of them and handed back to the PA, and paid, I think it was 5,000 rupees I was worth. That was paid over to them. Then another little complication arose because Arup wanted to give me 1,000 rupees, more or less, saying how nice it was to see me and sorry I was going and that sort of thing. And this was extremely awkward because it was impossible to accept it. So I tell the PA what was going on, and he said, well, I'll ask him if he'll give you something else as a memento. And so he agreed to do this, and he took off his little bandolier and a very small pistol and some ammunition, which he had on him, and he gave that to me, which I've got to this day. and that was a little present to me. Another funny thing is that at a later operation, I met Arup at a tea party in Tonk, given by the PA, South Waziristan, and a chap called Hay. And there we sat at tea together, and through an interpreter, had a little chat about the old days, which was really quite interesting. Of course, well, that was not, we were not bombing him at that time in the second operation.
You'd obviously made quite an impression on
him. Yes, we were quite friendly.
That's quite a lucky escape you had then with that, didn't
you? Well, the lucky escape, of course, was not going straight into a hill in the fog. That's what the other two poor chaps, I'm afraid, did so. They must have gone off a bit the other way, in other words, what you might call uphill, and they ran into the ground not very far from Rosmuk, actually.
When you were doing these bombing operations, what degree of accuracy were you in fact able to achieve in relation to these targets that have been pointed out to you?
Well, the orders were one should not go below 3,000 feet. The object of that being that a chance shot from the ground, you shouldn't really lay yourself open to a chance shot from the ground. And from 3,000 feet, it was moderately accurate, only moderately. But given a target in a village, you may not actually hit the target, but you certainly hit the village.
Did you always use high explosive, or did you use other forms of bombs?
No, we had incendiary as well, because they had a sort of courtyard surrounded by thorn bushes, which burnt up very well. They were very spectacular, and my impression was that they didn't care for that much.
And what about delayed action bombs?
Yes, we had, certainly we had short delay action bombs, because I remember wondering whether this dud was a delay action or not. Near which we were sitting. And as far as I remember, it was something like 30 minutes was the most delay. No, I think we perhaps had one or two longer than that, because I seem to remember that there was an idea of dropping a delay action bomb last thing at night, which would then go off in the middle of the night. So it must have been a few longer than that. But I think most of them were 30 minutes delay.
How many of these bombing missions did you in fact take part in during your 5 years in India? Were they quite frequent occurrences when you were there?
Not with the actual bombing. No, we had that one. And then the next one was a slightly bigger one after we'd left Dardoni. In fact, when we got to Kohat, I think within a month we moved to Tonk, from which we operated for the second operation, which was a different tribe altogether, somewhere away from Arup. That was on a slightly bigger scale, because that was a wing operation, not a squadron operation, and it became known unofficially as Pink's War, Wing Commander Pink being the commanding officer of number one wing at Peshawar. And five squadron were in it, and I think by that time it was 20 squadron within Peshawar. They were in it, and 27 and 60, the two bomber squadrons, were also in it. So there were four squadrons operating, but there again, I think the whole of five squadron was employed, but I think the others only had flights.
Did you go out to bomb as a squadron?
No, never.
Just in flights?
No, never. Never more than that I remember, never more than flights.
You also attempted some night bombing while you were at Rizalpur, you told me. Was that a tricky exercise?
That was the third very small operation. That was from Rizalpur. That was the Momans. The Momans were immediately north of Peshawar, not in Waziristan at all. And they were giving trouble. They were, I think, massing to come down into the plains just to cause trouble. And we did a very small amount of bombing there. But we did try night bombing, moonlight night, and it was extremely hard to pick anything up, of course, with just a few lights, few little fires about, which you could pinpoint without knowing exactly where they were. And the idea really, I think, was to cause a certain amount of terror in flying over and then dropping a few bombs, hoping that they'd be somewhere near somebody.
Did you, in fact, have some difficulty navigating at night?
Not in finding the general area, but almost impossible to pinpoint anything. Certainly you couldn't pinpoint a target, small target.
Did you have, you had sufficient aids for navigation to be able to go out somewhere and get back safely?
Well, night flying at that time was almost entirely moonlight, and moonlight, very clear moonlight in that area, was very light indeed. From the point of view of getting from A to B, it was almost like daylight.
Did you form any impression of how effective these actions were that you took part in? Did you hear subsequently?
Well, each one was totally successful without the movement of troops. I mean, Arup capitulated without any troop movement. In Pink's War, there was no troop movement, and eventually, it took a long time, Pink's War, compared with the 3 days we had, 3 or 4 days we had. But eventually, they capitulated completely, and the moment war never came to anything, fizzled out. I think they dispersed and went home.
Did you feel, as an RAF officer, that you might in fact have been allowed more scope to put this kind of method of control into effect in India?
No, I don't think so. These particular operations we did were very good examples, and there weren't any others. I mean, those were the three times when action was required, when bombs were actually dropped.
On a professional level, what were your relations like with the army? Did you cooperate well together? Was there any friction?
I would have said we cooperated excellently. In Waziristan, of course, you had two lots of what are called scouts. They had the South Waziristan scouts and the Tochi scouts, who lived at Miran Shah alongside Dardoni. We saw a lot of them, and we cooperated a lot with them, not only in their little exercises, but also shoots. When you had a shoot, when you went out shooting in Waziristan, they had to do an exercise, picketing the heights, while you walked up the valley to shoot. I mean, it was a sort of operation combined with a shoot. And they used to ask us down. We had a lot of fun with them.
What were these shoots?
There's a bird called a sisi, which is a sort of partridge, and a bird called a chikor, which is a sort of pheasant. I mean, that's the best way of describing them. One was small and one was bigger.
So this was sort of combining business with pleasure?
Yeah, exercise for the scouts and shooting for us, shooting for the officers. Quite good. And then the South Waziristan scouts, they were at a place called Sawakai, which was on the south end of Waziristan, and they worked much more up between Tonk and Wana and that part. Then there was a PA North Waziristan lived at Peshawar, and the PA South Waziristan lived at Tonk. We had excellent relations. And the army headquarters, who controlled the whole thing, was at Dera Ismail Khan, D.I.K. And we had two generals there during that year. The first one was Jacob. There were two high Indian Army Jacobs. And I can't remember their names now, but this was not the one who became very well known. This was the brother. And then after that, Sir Torquil Matheson, he took over. They were both very good to us. They came up each to see us once.
You didn't get any impression that they were antagonistic towards the RAF.
Not at my level.
No.
What went on further back, I don't know.
You were in India for 5 years, from 23 to 28. Mm. Was 5 years the length of duty that you were expecting
well,
when you went out there?
When I went out, it was 4 years. And while I was out there, about halfway through, it increased to 5 years. At that time, we were at Whittlepore with the Central India Horse, who were a great polo playing and leave in England, Richmond. They were always, hardly ever had any officers there as far as we could see. And so we coined the phrase, join the Air Force and see India, join the Indian Army and see England, which amused them very much.
Were you able to take any leave during your 5 years?
Yes, I can. After the period was increased from 4 years to five, I did come home on leave in the summer of the autumn, almost, of the my fourth year. Let's say at the end of 27, I came home for 2 months.
What about while you were actually in India? Did you travel at all in India on leave?
I had two marvellous trips to Kashmir. The first one was 3 months, because serving in Waziristan, you got an extra month's leave. So I had 3 months leave, and the second one I had 2 months leave. And the first one I went out to Baltistan, north of Skardu, chief thing being ibex, and also red and black bear. And the second time I went to Astor, the chief game there being markhor and a smallish sheep type called Sharpu, who were very tricky to get near. They were very wily animals, and also again ibex. Because you had to make tremendous arrangements beforehand. First of all, you had to book a nulla. You could only go where you got a license to go, and you could only shoot so many animals of each kind on your license.
Who was that controlled by?
Oh, by Kashmir.
The government?
Well, Indian government, through Kashmir. But the place you had to write to was an address in Kashmir. But it was the most marvellous holiday, of course. But hard work, very hard work. You walked every mile. And the one to...